From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, David Bowie. This summer marks the 30th anniversary of his album The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars. Ziggy helped define glam rock and turned Bowie into a superstar. In celebration, the album has been reissued on CD and the Ziggy film opened in theaters. We'll talk with Bowie about his former alter ego and about his new CD, Heathen, which features Bowie's latest songs. Also, our TV critic David Bianculli tells us what he actually likes about this summer's big hit American Idol and what he doesn't. On tonight's edition, we find out who wins the talent search contest. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush said today that he'll seek the approval of Congress before ordering military action against Iraq. After meeting with congressional leaders at the White House, the president said Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein is a threat and the United States doesn't have the option of doing nothing. Republican Senator John McCain said he was favorably impressed at this morning's meeting.
The president made a strong argument for the regime change, for the threat, and I believe that he has a convincing case. He'll be taking it to the Congress and the American people, and I believe that both the Congress and the American people will support it.
President Bush said he'll also try to persuade the international community to support his view, including the leaders of France, China, and Russia, who are now opposed to military action against Iraq. Meanwhile, Iraqi President Saddam Hussein says his country wants an overall solution to its crisis with Washington. Kate Seeley reports from Bahrain.
Iraqi television quoted Saddam Hussein as saying that Baghdad wants a comprehensive solution that leads to the lifting of sanctions on Iraq based on UN Security Council resolutions. In talks with a Yemeni official, Saddam said Iraq had implemented all of its UN commitments, but that the world body had not reciprocated. Iraq has said for years that it has met UN demands that its weapons of mass destruction be destroyed. In return, it's calling upon the UN to lift a 12-year-old embargo on the country. Baghdad refuses to meet UN demands that weapons inspectors be allowed to return until sanctions are lifted. Saddam also told a group of Arab parliamentarians gathered in Baghdad that Iraq does not want a war with the U.S., but would defeat the Americans if attacked. Kate Seeley, NPR News, Bahrain.
Senate Republicans say they'll fight any effort to limit the president's flexibility in running a Department of Homeland Security. NPR's Pam Fessler reports.
Senate Minority Leader Trent Lott says Republicans hope to change the Homeland Security bill to give the president broad flexibility over personnel.
If we do not, the President of the United States will veto it, and we will sustain his veto, because this is too important to be done in a way where the president's hands are tied and where his managers and his secretary of that new department cannot do the job.
The issue over how much power the president should have to hire, fire, and reassign workers has become central to the debate over the new agency. Democrats say the president has all the authority he needs. Republicans say the president can't be hampered by civil service laws or union agreements when responding to the threat of terrorism. Debate over the bill could last for several more weeks. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials gained 117 points, or 1.4%, to close at 8425. The NASDAQ gained 28 points to close at 1292. This is NPR News. A Canadian Senate committee is recommending that the government legalize the use of marijuana. The committee says the current system of prohibitions is ineffective and should be replaced by a regulated system. Dan Karpinchuk reports.
The committee says it's not enough to decriminalize the use of marijuana, it should become legal for adults. It's not endorsing cannabis use for recreational consumption, but wants it treated as a personal choice not subject to criminal penalties. The senators are also calling for amnesty for anyone convicted of marijuana use under current or past legislation, and they say the production and sale of marijuana should be regulated in much the same way as alcohol. Senator Colin Kenny says the current system only boosts the power of criminals.
The main accomplishment that we'll see here is a reduction in criminality associated with the drug, and we think that's a very valuable benefit.
Any move to adopt the recommendations is sure to anger Washington, which has made it clear that it opposes any decriminalization of cannabis on its doorstep. For NPR News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
The Securities and Exchange Commission said today that two former top executives at Sunbeam Corporation have agreed to pay $700,000 to settle charges of improper accounting. Al Dunlap, the appliance company's former chief executive, agreed to pay $500,000. Former chief financial officer Russell Kirsch will pay $200,000. SEC officials said both men have been barred from ever serving as officers or directors of any public company. The two men neither admitted nor denied the allegations that they used illegal practices to make Sunbeam's revenues seem larger than they really were. In stocks today, the S&P 500 gained 15 points to close at 893. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation with a mandate from Andrew Carnegie to promote the advancement and diffusion of knowledge and understanding.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is David Bowie. This summer, in celebration of the 30th anniversary of his glam rock classic The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars, an expanded version of the album was reissued on CD, and the concert movie is playing in select theaters around the country. A retrospective of Bowie's work is running at the Museum of Television and Radio until September 29th. Ziggy was one of Bowie's early gender-bending alter egos, mixing androgyny and science fiction. He wore elaborate eye makeup and lipstick and dyed his hair a bright red. But even before Ziggy, Bowie had become an icon of glam rock after posing on the cover of his 1970 album, The Man Who Sold the World, wearing a gown and makeup. In much of his career, each album seemed to find Bowie with a different image and a new sound to match his new look. That persona-driven phase of his career ended years ago, but he still inhabits different characters in his movie roles. Bowie has a new CD called Heathen, featuring his latest songs, and he just completed a tour with Moby. Let's start with a song from his new CD. This is Afraid. David Bowie, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much indeed.
Do you think of your new CD as having a theme or a concept?
I didn't initially. I had two songs that I really sort of saw as bookends for the entire album. Well, one was Sunday, and the other one was called Heathen. And I recorded those two first. They became the sort of the whole focus for the album. But and I really judged the other songs by those two. They were my kind of yardstick, rule of thumb of the weight of the material. So it was really the weight of the material rather than subject matter that kind of ruled the day. And if songs sonically fitted within those two, then they became part of the album. And I guess that dictated the sensibility of the thing.
Do you have an alter ego to go with this particular CD?
Nope.
Is having an alter ego less important to you than it used to be?
I think much has been made of this alter ego business. I mean, I actually stopped creating characters in 1975, for albums anyway. The only time that I've adopted characterization again since that point for my own albums has been an album called Outside that I did with Brian Eno a few years ago, which really had a myriad. Maybe one too many characters, but had a lot of characters on that, and I played all the parts. But that was done as a sonic theatrical piece of music. But the character thing really is sort of, for me personally, rather ancient history. But it's kind of, I guess over here specifically in America, the soundbitey thing really kind of stays around, and you're known by the, you're defined by the two or three things that the largest amount of people know about, and that kind of is who you are publicly. And mine is really Ziggy Stardust, characters, Let's Dance. That's me in the American, frankly, in the American eye. But in fact, in Europe, I'm more kind of this bloke what writes lots of stuff. And I guess a greater number of the 26 or so albums that I've made are known in Europe than they are in America.
Well, will there be a video for the new CD?
No.
Do you feel like you're past the MTV age?
Oh, I think I was past the MTV when I hit 45, you know. I mean, I was lucky to get away with them then. I think, you know, you have to kind of face reality. And for me, radio and TV play for a younger generation, which is what radio and TV are aimed at in terms of music, are really not part of, are not going to be part of my life. So I have to rely, and many artists of my age have to rely on word of mouth. And I have very supportive fellow musicians, contemporaries and peers, and really young ones as well, who continually really speak out for me, which has been great. And opportunities with, say, friends like Moby, who invited me to do his tour this year. That sort of support really does such a lot. It's very good.
Your new CD was produced by Tony Visconti, who worked with you from your first album through...
And myself. It was a co-production.
Good, thank you. You worked together from your first album through your 1980 album, Scary Monsters. How did you get hooked up to work again now?
Well, we started talking about the possibility... I mean, we sort of reunited about 5 years ago. And we had, since that point, been talking about the possibility of doing another album together. And I was the one that was really quite reticent about doing it, because I'm very aware of how well thought of a lot of our earlier stuff is by the audience for those particular albums, the things that we did in the 70s and early 80s. And I didn't in any way want to cheapen or tarnish the reputation that we had. So it took me a very, very long time to figure out the way in to re-collaborating again. And it seemed to me that the best possible thing to do was take the emphasis off the production side of things and put it on quality and strength of songs. So I started stockpiling songs that I thought really were good sound pieces of work, so that we went into the studio with a very definite endpoint in view, we really didn't have to lean back on the past at all.
How is your sense of yourself as a performer different now at the age of 55 than it was when you were in your 20s and getting started and when you were in persona and doing the whole, you know, eye makeup and dyed hair and dresses,
yeah,
when you wanted
to do it? That was for 18 months, actually.
Right.
Which out of a career of nearly 40 years is not very long. However, yeah. I'll answer your question. I'm not actually a very keen performer. I like putting shows together. I like putting events together. In fact, everything I do is about the conceptualizing and realization of a piece of work, whether it's the recording or the performance side. And kind of when I put the thing together, I don't mind doing it for a few weeks, but then, quite frankly, I get incredibly bored because I don't see myself so much as a performer. I mean, I don't live for the stage. I don't live for an audience.
Can I stop you and say that I'm really surprised to hear that?
Most people are.
Yeah, because I always thought of you as somebody who really relished the theater aspect of performance who very successfully made theater a part of music performance.
Frankly, if I could get away with not having to perform, I'd be very happy. It's not my favorite thing to do. As I say, I don't mind trying it out and making sure something seems to work well, but I really do rather want to move on, because I think it's rather a waste of time endlessly singing the same songs every night for a year. And it's just not what I want to do. What I like doing is writing and recording and much more on the, I guess, the on that creative level. It's fun interpreting songs and all that, but I wouldn't like it as a living.
Let me play something else from your new CD. In fact, why don't we hear the title track, Heathen. Do you want to say anything about this particular song before we hear it?
Yeah, okay. I called it Heathen because the word pagan is so overused, as it is a dialogue between a man and life itself, rather than a man and his God or his, you know, some supposed universal agent or an intelligence of some kind. So it has kind of a pagan feel to it. It's a man confronting and resigning himself to the fact that life is gradually saying goodbye to him. Hence the word heathen for that. Now, I used it as a catch-all for the album, as I realized that the resonance of the word heathen was really quite applicable to the way that we conduct ourselves, and always have, of course, that we're really morally and spiritually in the same endless decline that we always have been.
Oh, speak for yourself. No, just kidding.
No, I know. You know, even my best friends and I argue about this one, but I'm really quite negative about it. I don't think evolution has much place in our vocabulary at all. I don't think we evolve at all. I think we're quite as awful as we were 20,000 years ago.
Well, with that, let's hear your song, Heathen, the title track of David Bowie's new CD.
Waiting for something. Looking for someone. Is there no reason? Have I stayed too long?
That's Heathen, the title track of David Bowie's new CD. We'll talk with Bowie after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David Bowie. He has a new CD called Heathen. This summer, a digitally remastered CD of his 1972 album, The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars, was released for its 30th anniversary. Here's the title track.
Now, Ziggy played guitar, jamming good with Webb and Gilly and the Spiders from Mars. He played it left hand, but made it too far. Became the special man, then we were Ziggy's band. Ziggy really sang, screwed up eyes and screwed down hairdo, like some cat from Japan. He could lick 'em by smiling, he could leave 'em to hang. They came on so loaded, man, well hung in snow white tan.
Now, your movie Ziggy Stardust is back in theaters. It's been re-released. I'm going to ask you to describe creating the character, what you thought about when you were coming up with it, why you came up with it.
Well, I guess the simple one-liner is that myself and my mates, and I guess a certain contingent of the musicians in London at the beginning of the 70s were fed up with Denim and the hippies. And I think we kind of wanted to go somewhere else. And some of us, I think, us more pompous, arty ones, probably read too much George Steiner and kind of got the idea that we were entering to this kind of post-culture age, and that we better do something postmodernist quickly before somebody else did.
Did you see the kind of gender aspects of your performance? You know, dressing. You know, sometimes wearing an evening gown, sometimes, you know, often wearing lipstick, dyeing your hair, lots of eye makeup. Did you see the gender stuff as being a statement about postmodernism or a statement about sexuality?
Well, neither. I think they were just devices to create this new distancing from the subject matter. There was a kind of a diffidence, an idea that really hadn't been thought of before, that the history of rock could be recycled in a different way and brought back into focus without the luggage that comes along with it. It was a sense, a very strong sense of irony, I think, it became the foundation of two or three of us. I mean, I'm wary of the word glam because I think that became the all-inclusive term for any bloke with lipstick on, which is fine, you know, and that's what it is when it comes down to the public level. The public, obviously, they take things in a very simplistic fashion, and so they should. That's why we have such wonderful television. but I think that, as I say, I guess it was, you know, kind of that art school kind of posturing that the Brits usually have. And it was, I guess, people like myself and Roxy Music that had a different agenda about taking up music. I think we all were kind of, well, maybe I can't speak for Roxy, of course, but some of us were failed artists or reluctant artists. You know, the choices were either, for most Brit musicians at that point, painting or making music. And I think we opted for music, one, because it was more exciting, two, you could actually earn a living at it. But I think we brought a lot of our aesthetic sensibilities to it, in terms of that we wanted to manufacture a new kind of vocabulary, a new kind of currency. And so the so-called gender bending, the picking up of maybe aspects of the avant-garde and aspects of, for me personally, things like the Kabuki Theatre in Japan, and German Expressionist movies, and poetry by Baudelaire, God, it's so long ago now. Everything from Presley to Edith Piaf went into this mix of this hybridization, this pluralism about what, in fact, rock music was and could become. That wasn't really a very simple answer to anything at all, was it?
No, but it was a good answer.
Well, it was a pudding, you know. It really was a pudding. It was a pudding of new ideas. And we were terribly excited. And I think we took it on our shoulders that we were creating the 21st century in 1971. That was the idea. And we wanted to just blast everything in the past, rather like the Vorticists did at the beginning of the century in Britain, or the Dadaists did in Europe. You know, it was the same sensibility of everything is rubbish and all rubbish is wonderful.
No, before you became David Bowie, when you were playing with other bands before forming your own, did you do the Denim thing? You know, did you wear a T-shirt and jeans on stage?
Very, very rarely, actually. No, it wasn't really something that I... because I never believed it. It always felt like you were trying too hard to look like the audience or something. That whole thing about the artistic integrity, which, of course, I've never bought into with any artist. It's just not a real thing.
Wait, so let me stop you and see if I got this straight. Wearing a T-shirt and jeans seemed phony to you, but wearing mascara and eye makeup seemed right.
I didn't say that wearing a glamorization of the rock artist was any truer.
Oh, okay, right. It's artifice, but it's
artifice.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
okay.
I think my main point would be is that the T-shirt and denims thing, in my mind, was also an artifice.
Right.
I didn't feel comfortable in that because I didn't feel like one of the working men. I mean, I could never be a blue-collary kind of Springsteen-y type artist because I don't believe I am that. I don't believe I, you know, could ever represent that. And it is merely representation.
Well, what was your family background?
I wonder. well, my father worked for a children's home called Dr. Bernardo's Homes. They're a charity.
I see.
He was a charity worker, in fact. My mother was a housewife. My father was from a farming family, agricultural family in the north of England. And my mother came from a very working class.
Well, getting back to Ziggy again, which is back in theaters, you know, the story of Ziggy Stardust is a story of someone who becomes very famous. It's the story of rock and roll fame. Becomes very famous, and then fame becomes his downfall. He's kind of killed in a way by fame. What did that fable that you created mean to you at the time? Is that the way you saw rock and
roll?
Well,
I can only really look at it the way I look at it now, which is, I think, independently of myself, Ziggy Stardust has his own life. He's his own creation. And you know what? Good luck to him. But frankly, for me, I kind of closed the door on him in 1973.
Right.
And I'm very happy that he's having such success and that people still like him and all that. I heard he got married. Anyway, I personally have another life, you know, which doesn't belong to Ziggy Stardust, and I do tend to not really get that involved in what I've done in the past. I do kind of leave that up to other people, and that's much how I feel about Ziggy. I kind of prefer the audience and maybe writers or commentators or whatever, to make what they will of the Ziggy Stardust period and character, because it actually doesn't interest me much now.
David Bowie, he'll be back in the second half of the show. He has a new CD called Heathen, and there's a new 30th anniversary edition of his Ziggy Stardust album. From it, this is Rock and Roll Suicide. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Takes a cigarette, puts it in your mouth. You pull on your finger, then another finger, then cigarette. The water wall is calling, it lingers, then you forget. Oh, 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 you're a rock and roll suicide. You're too old to lose it, too young to choose it, and the clock waits so patiently.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, David Bowie looks back on his childhood years, and TV critic David Bianculli tells us why he thinks this summer's hit show, American Idol, isn't all that bad, but it isn't all that good either.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with David Bowie. He has a new CD called Heathen, and there's a new 30th anniversary digitally remastered CD of his album The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars. The Ziggy concert movie is playing in many theaters around the country. Ziggy is a glam rock classic. One of Bowie's signature songs, Changes, was released a year before Ziggy on his album Hunky Dory.
And my time was running wild in million dead-end streets. And every time I thought I got it made, it seemed the taste was not so sweet. So I turned myself to face me. But I've never caught a glimpse of how the others must see the faker. I'm much too fast to take that test.
Changes.
Turn and face the strain.
Changes.
Don't wanna be a richer man.
Changes.
Turn and face the strain.
Changes.
It's gonna have to be a different man. Thou may change me, but I can't trace time.
Let's get back to our interview with David Bowie. I've read about something that I'm sure a lot of people have asked you about, which is that when you were 16, you were in a fight that blinded you in one eye and I think paralyzed the muscle. I have no idea, though, what happened in the fight. Did you typically get into a lot of fights when you were that age, or was this an unusual development?
Well, firstly, no, I was 13, not 16.
Oh, okay.
And it was my best friend hit me because I'd pulled his girlfriend. So I think probably in his mind he had every right to do that.
And how horrifying was it?
The greatest thing, well, it was very uncomfortable. the best thing part of it, of course, is that we still remain very close friends. And I can't remember, it must be, 40 years later.
And you lost the vision in that eye?
Pretty much so, yeah.
As an artist, how has it been difficult to see what you want to see, to have full depth perception for creating and for looking?
I probably take in more in one eye than most people do with two, so I think I'm all right.
Mm-hmm. What were you listening to when you were a teenager?
Oh, wow. It was so... I think the only music I didn't listen to was country and western, and that holds to this day. It's much easier for me to say the kind of music I didn't listen to was pretty much that. I mean, everything from jazz to classical to popular.
Mm-hmm.
And Tibetan horns were a great part of it in 1966, 67. I love Tibetan horns.
You've said that...
I still love Tibetan horns. I think Tibetan horns are one of the most wonderful sounds in the world. And Tibetan chanting. Uh-huh. It's great.
You've named Anthony Newley as one of your influences.
Oh, hugely. Not the Anthony Newley you know, probably.
Who can I turn to, Anthony Newley?
Well, yes and no. I mean, he kind of kept on singing that song when he came to America, but his whole life changed. Everything about him changed when he came to America. I think it seems that he would like to have become very much part of the Rat Pack or all that.
Right.
Las Vegas thing. But in Britain, he was kind of something else before he came to the States. And he had a stirring, magical television series called This Very Strange World of Gurney Slade, which was really one of the most extraordinary existential comedy things that could have been seen in those years. Most of the tapes have been lost, needless to say, by the BBC, but I do have one show. There is one show that remains from really quite a short series because it was thought of as too weird for British television. He did an awful lot of things like that were kind of strange and odd, and I liked his approach to what he was doing. He was trying to widen his own field, I think. But he kind of gave up on all that when he came to the States, because I think it was just harder to do that kind of thing in America. It has to be a lot more simple over here. And or rather less convoluted. It had to be more clearly defined in the States, because it's such a large population over here.
Did you grow up thinking of yourself as a singer, or did you start singing because you wanted to sing, you know, because you wanted to perform?
No, what I wanted to do when I was 9 years old, I wanted to be the baritone sax player in the Little Richard Band. I probably also wanted to be black at that particular time as well. And I got my father to help me out with a saxophone, and we bought it over like a 2-year period. We had something in Britain then called the hire purchase system, or HP, and I bought it on HP, which is like you paid 2 and 6 pence a week.
Oh, buying it on time.
Yeah, over like 1,000 years. So in the end, it cost you maybe twice as much as if you could have afforded cash.
Right.
And I started playing around with local rock bands, you know, with the alto, and then, in a nutshell, somebody fell ill one night, the lead singer in one of the bands, and they knew I could sing, so they asked me if I would stand up. And I quite enjoyed it, actually, I must say, at 14. It was a real trip, you know, to have girls wave at you and smile and everything just because you opened your mouth and sang. I really wanted to do more than anything else up until I was around 16, 17, was write musicals.
Was write music.
Musicals.
Oh, musicals.
I really wanted to write musicals. That's what I wanted to do more than anything else. Because I like rock music, I kind of moved into that sphere, somehow thinking that somewhere along the line I'd be able to put the two together. And I suppose I very nearly did with the Ziggy character, but I had such short attention span and got disinterested so quickly after I'd created some kind of project that I wanted to move on, and I never really got the book together for the thing. So I had all the songs and the characters. But by the time we'd gotten it on the road and I'd been doing it for 18 months, oh, God, I couldn't wait to move on to something else.
So when you say you wanted to write musicals, did you want to write, like, Rodgers and Hart kind of musicals or Hair? I mean, what?
No, that was my point. No, yeah. My point was I wanted to rewrite how rock music was perceived.
Oh, I
and
see.
I
yeah,
thought
right.
that I could do some kind of vehicle involving rock musicals
right.
and presenting rock and characters and storyline in a completely different fashion.
Mm-hmm. So was singing something you started doing to come so that you could do that kind of theater?
It was it was the conception that, I mean, God, I would love to have handed it on to somebody else, and I guess Ziggy would have been the perfect vehicle to have done with. I don't know why, to this day, I didn't find some other kid after I'd done it for like 6 months and said, here, I'll put the wig on and send him out and do the gigs, you know. I mean, it would have been much the best thing to do, and then I could have moved on quicker to something else. But that comes back to what I was saying. I needed to sing because nobody else was singing my songs.
Right.
So I had to do it myself.
You were briefly in a mime group before.
Yes, the Lindsay Kemp Mime Company.
Yeah, before becoming a solo musician.
Yeah. It all kind of ran. I tended to be. I seem to be kind of involved in so many things all at the same time, which is still how I kind of operate today. I can't keep my fingers out of any pies.
Well, are there things that you learned or became aware of through that mime group that you said, yeah, that I really like that, I'm going to work with that in my own performances?
I think everything that I learned about stagecraft and carrying through, creating a through point for a theatrical device. I think Lindsay Kemp really introduced me to the work of Jean Genet, and through that, I kind of kept re-educating myself about other prose writers and poets.
Mm-hmm.
He opened an awful lot of doors for me in terms of a new approach to what I could do. I could never have done what I did without being involved with Lindsay Kemp's company.
While we're on the subject of mime, I have to mention that in the Ziggy movie, you do those hands
walking across the glass wall thing.
I know. That's my proudest moment of the Ziggy Stardust movie.
The dreaded mime thing.
Yeah. Well, meme over meme here, isn't it? I know. It's so utterly abhorred over here. We didn't know that in England because we love it over there. And it broke our hearts when we came over here and realised that memes were kind of tantamount to some kind of artistic criminals.
My guest is David Bowie. He has a new CD called Heathen. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with David Bowie. He has a new CD called Heathen. Like a lot of people, you had a period where drugs were a problem, and you once said that you feel like you have such an addictive personality, you even stay away from Tylenol or Advil. I'm wondering if you think that kind of addictive personality part of you has also influenced you as an artist, if you're equally kind of obsessive when it comes to writing music or recording or performing?
I think it does occupy a lot of my time in terms of, I think I have an abundantly healthy curiosity about life around me specifically, and how we put ourselves together culturally. And I think it served me well as an artist, in as much as I'm really inquiring continually into how things are made and why we make them, and the significance or meanings behind things. It will only be productive if there's an element of, or some sense of cohesion or talent within the artists themselves. I mean, I know a lot of musicians and writers and painters that are completely obsessive and addicted to both drugs and what they do. Mm-hmm. And the ones who are good at what they do tend to produce good work, and the ones who don't. And maybe both will produce huge volumes of it.
You're a father now for the second time?
Yes.
And there's a difference of, I think, about 30 years between your first child's birth and your second.
My son's, in his 30s, and my daughter's 2.
Is being a father now really different than it was the first time around?
Well, in as much as that I'm, of course, I was a young and ambitious artist when my son was born, and I think it took me on the road probably much too much, in as much that I really wasn't around as much as I should have been. But I think in the haze of being a really ambitious artist, I think you lose sight of those particular agendas, you know. At this time around, I suppose I was a lot more thoughtful before going into fatherhood, and I'm spending most of my time with my child.
Because rock and roll started as a youth music, everybody always wondered, well, will rock and roll continue to live? And what about the artists themselves? What about when they pass 30? What about when they pass 40 or when they pass 50? You're in your mid-50s now. Is that an issue for you? Do you feel like you have satisfactorily found a way to be a man in his mid-50s playing your music without feeling like what you're playing is... You know what I'm saying. That you're playing music that speaks to who you are and where you are now.
Having not really written any generational songs, I think maybe 2 or 3 of the songs that I've ever written have any bearing on the age of the listener. My stuff tends to be far more concerned with the spiritual and with subjects like isolation and being miserable. So I think that sort of touches on really any age group. So in my terms, they're just songs. The vehicle for those songs is a music that did indeed start as a youth culture music. But it is aged well in itself, and it has become a vast and complex thing now, with so many subdivisions and styles and variations. No, it's just what I do. I mean, I wouldn't know how to write and play any other kind of music, frankly.
David Bowie, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
David Bowie has a new CD called Heathen. There's a limited edition version that has a new recording of the song Conversation Piece, which Bowie first recorded in 1969 and released on his album Space Oddity. Here's both versions back to back.
I took this walk to ease my mind, to find out what's gnawing at me. Wouldn't think to look at me, that I spent a lot of time in education. It all seems so long ago. I'm a thinker, not a talker. I've no one to talk to anyway. I can't see the road for the rain in my eyes.
I live above the grocery store. About his broken English, tries to be a friend to me. But for all the years of reading conversation, I stand without a word to say.
Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli on American Idol. This is Fresh Air.
The most popular TV series of the summer has been the Fox Talent Search Contest American Idol. The season finale is tonight. TV critic David Bianculli has these thoughts on the phenomenon and the talent.
Tonight's finale of American Idol can go one of two ways. The winner, the one who emerges from all these audition and voting rounds as the most popular singer out of 10,000 unknown competitors, will be either Justin Guarini or Kelly Clarkson. The final vote comes from fans who phoned a toll-free line after last night's show to vote as many times as they wished while lines were open. If teeny bopper teens clogged the lines, voting with blind devotion for the cute young man with hair like Sideshow Bob's, then Guarini may win. If talent is the deciding factor, then the first American Idol will be Kelly. Here's a snippet from each singer's performance last night. Justin first, then Kelly. Both are singing original songs written for American Idol. Songs that will comprise the winner's first single, which will hit stores in less than 2 weeks.
Some people wait a
lifetime for a moment like this. Some people wait a lifetime for a moment like this.
I never lived before your love.
There are certain things I really like about American Idol and have enjoyed from the start. The concept, based on a proven British hit called Pop Idol, is brilliant in its simplicity. It's a high-stakes talent contest with an interactive element built into its final stages, and with entertaining and sometimes acerbic judges assessing every performance. It's already made stars not only of its finalists, but of the show's three judges. Paula Abdul has found a second-act career here, and record producers Randy Jackson and especially Simon Cowell are celebrities now. In the first two installments of American Idol, when these three judges were weeding through some very raw talent, Simon's blunt assessments were especially entertaining. Because he has been less frequent and lavish with his praise than the other two, his compliments weigh more. Even in last night's show, after Paula gave her typically diplomatic assessment of both competitors, Simon was blunt with his assessments and preferences. Though, at this point, the final outcome is out of his hands, no matter what he says.
Kelly, you have a voice that can make grown men cry and young boys wish that they were grown men.
I'm crying now.
Talking about you.
Justin, if you were to look up it in the dictionary, your picture would be right there. You have it, you are it.
Woo!
Well done.
Mr. Simon Cowell.
I don't actually understand a word Paula's saying anymore. It's like a new language. Okay, I would say you both did great. Justin, I can tell you, having worked with Justin, he's actually one of the nicest people I've ever met. And after the horrors of some of the artists I met at the VMA Awards, these two are a credit to what pop stars are really all
Amen.
About.
There you go. Amen. Amen.
What I would say, just to finish quickly, Justin, you did great. If it was my vote, who is the American Idol this year, you've got to give it to Kelly Clarkson.
What I hate most about American Idol are the two young, obnoxious, idiotic hosts, whom I won't even identify by name because their egos have been overfed enough already. But if I had the power to vote them off, they would have been unemployed again after week one. I also don't like the cynicism and blandness behind the marketing of these singers. But the same can-do attitude worked fine for TV in the 1960s, when NBC held auditions for performers to copy the successful formula of another British import, the Beatles. The result was the Monkees, who ended up rebelling, like Frankenstein's monster, against their own creator. Paula Abdul, on a talk show earlier this week, said the American Idol idea goes all the way back to Star Search. Actually, it goes back a lot further than that. The mean judges can be traced to the Gong Show, the interactive element to your hit parade, and the talent showcase all the way back to radio in the 1930s, with Major Bowes and his original amateur hour. On TV, Ted Mack took that over, and Arthur Godfrey's talent scouts made the format in the early 1950s one of TV's biggest hits. The variety show is so dormant as a TV genre right now that I'm excited by anything that may breathe new life to it. And even if I wouldn't rush out to buy the bland music that the first American Idol is being forced to release, it's good to know this one thing. In the summer of 2002, the most popular TV show in the country was one with a positive message and outcome, rather than one of the many mean-spirited reality shows we've been hit with lately. Our American Idol could have been Anna Nicole Smith. Of course, for that to happen, Idol would have had to have been spelled I-D-L-E.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. The great vibraphonist Lionel Hampton died over the holiday weekend at the age of 94. Here's one of his classic recordings with the Benny Goodman Sextet from 1939. This is Memories of You. The Benny Goodman Sextet with Lionel Hampton. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Sherrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of A Traitor to Memory by Elizabeth George, author of A Great Deliverance. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with New York Times foreign affairs columnist Tom Friedman about Iraq and his recent travels through the Arab world. His post-September 11th columns, which won a Pulitzer Prize, are collected in his new book, Longitudes and Attitudes. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.